for being a bit tardy, but we ended the last session late. I'll now call our third case for today, 05AP1629, Stone versus Acuity. Mr. Simpson, we're glad to see you back again, arguing on behalf of Acuity.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. May it please the court, appearing for Acuity, the defendant, appellant petitioner, Arthur Simpson, co-counsel with me, Michelle Johnson. If it please the court, I took the liberty of having a copy of the pertinent statute made, and I would request that if it is acceptable that the clerk pass that out to the members of the court. I provided Mr. Alonzo with a copy of that before our argument today.
Mr. Alonzo, do you have any objection? Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to be here today to address the what I've labeled the violation issue with respect to the notice statute here. We previously presented oral argument which primarily focused on whether or not there was a violation. I do not intend to retread any ground that was covered with respect to that matter. There are, however, three central points that I'd like to address with the court. Number one is that I believe the remedy cases, many of which the court asked us to address, do reflect on whether or not there is a violation here with respect to the notice statute. The second theme that I want to address is the fact that there is no private right of action with respect under our state statutes to revise or rewrite the insurance policy to create $1 million worth of coverage. Cases where there has been a change in an insurance policy under Section 631.15 have involved the situation where the court revised a policy to, quote, conform to the law, close quote. And that's the specific quotation from the Brunson case from our state as far as what was done. The Brunson case is a very good example of the court reforming a policy to conform to the law. The central issue that has to be faced in this appeal is just where is there in the insurance code a statutory provision that says that you reform or rewrite the policy to have this $1 million remedy. At best, this is what's a so-called minimum limit state as you analyze the cases from around the country. Frankly, there's no remedy in this statute that the court can revise the policy to conform to, as we had in the Brunson situation.
The insurance code 6.77 that's been referenced in your opposing counsel's brief, that indicates in Wisconsin that personal umbrella shall have a minimum limit of $1 million.
Liability policy shall. I think maybe Houdini or Kreskin could determine from that there's some requirement that the UIM coverage match that. We do not have that. Does refer to, it's a definition of what an umbrella policy
is. I don't have it right in front of me, but I have read it probably a couple of times, not nightly, but just in preparation.
Good for you.
I have other things. Anyway, you're right. Indeed, it does define an umbrella policy, but it also indicates that an umbrella policy can, as I read it, couldn't be issued in an amount less than $1 million. That's the way I read that. Did you read it that way also?
I haven't read it nightly, and I haven't read it recently, okay. But my recall is that's what the definition of an umbrella policy included.
I mean, you can have more. Lots of times you have $3 million, and I think that was in their opposing.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are defined in the statute books to say, well, I have this definition. Therefore, from there, I would read in that, Wisconsin is a state that has statutory language that says you must offer the coverage, or the coverage for underinsured motorists must be the equivalent of the bodily injury coverage or of the UM coverage, or even that the notice statute applies to an umbrella policy. you have to make a lot of inferential leaps of faith in one direction or the other to come to the conclusion that somehow that has the authority for the court to rewrite this policy to create $1 million worth of coverage. I think a big issue, and the third issue I wanted to address.
If I may, let me just follow
sure.
up. You came out in 1999 with a product of an umbrella policy with UIM coverage. Is the only amount of UIM coverage that you offered in your umbrella policies in the amount of $1 million?
I don't know that for a fact. I'm not an underwriter, and I couldn't represent that to you one way or the other.
And so that policy, there's nothing in the record that would indicate that when the company came out in 1999 with the product of UIM coverage in personal umbrella, there's nothing in the record that reflects what amount the UIM coverage was available in. If it was only available in the amount of the policy limits of the minimum of the umbrella, which would have been $1 million, or did they offer it, let's say, oh, you can get UIM in your personal umbrella policy for $500,000. We don't know that. That's not in the record, you're saying?
Since all this basically came up at the appellate level, you're correct. There's no record with respect to that particular issue. I know that UIM coverage can be written at various levels, $300,000, $500,000. I've
question.
Seen it written at those levels,
yeah,
but
so
I don't
I've
know
heard.
How it ties into the umbrella endorsement, if you will, because
yeah, well,
I know we have a fundamental disagreement about what's a policy and what's an endorsement.
But I'm not sure that I've seen it written, as we have here, $300,000 in the underlying policy, but that doesn't answer the question of what it's written in the umbrella policy. I don't know. I haven't seen anything in the umbrella
And that's
policy.
One of the issues when this all comes up at the appellate level as opposed to the trial court level in terms of the record that you have with respect to such nuances. I don't know how in the world that really, quite frankly, I don't know how it makes much difference. The Wisconsin, and the third point I wanted to make here is that the cases from around the country talk about so-called minimum limit states and full recovery states. And we have even in the full recovery states, you have a reluctance to simply impose this $1 million after-the-fact insurance coverage in some of the cases that we referred to in our brief, which I'll try to address this afternoon. The bottom line is that if you look at Wisconsin's cases, you look at the Wisconsin statute, there is nothing in there that says that this is a situation where UIM coverage shall be offered up to the bodily injury limits, shall be offered up to whatever the UM limits are, whatever. There's a couple of ways these full recovery statutes are worded, but there's nothing in there to suggest to anyone that would be the remedy here. What the statute provides, and it's in the final section of the statute on page 2 of what I provided you, is that you provide limits, I believe it's of at least 50, 100, 50 per person, 100 per accident. And that's the only thing in the statute that refers to any type of remedy.
Counsel, as to remedy, what about the fact that under the circumstances and facts of this case, there was a stipulation that if there was coverage found, the remedy was going to be set at a certain amount?
The stipulation issue relates to, and I have a copy of the stipulation, which is at pages 68 through 71 of our appendix. The stipulation itself provided that defendant Acuity, as alleged insurer, have negotiated an agreement as to the amount plaintiffs would be entitled to receive, with the understanding such agreement does not waive any rights of appeal of Acuity with respect to the decision on Acuity's motion for summary judgment and motion to reconsider. Stipulation further provides $500,000 as a figure Acuity would pay in the event insurance coverage is found on appeal to exist from Acuity. There's nothing in this stipulation that indicates that Acuity agreed that if somehow there were a Rebernick theory or what became a Stone theory, that there was any waiver of the right to determine if this insurance would have been purchased. You have to understand what transpired here at the trial court level. The plaintiff's original complaint did not allege any type of Rebernick or Stone theory. They did not allege they did not receive notice. They argued contextual ambiguity. We filed a reconsideration on contextual ambiguity. And at that point, the Rebernick Court of Appeals decision was decided where there was a dissenting opinion indicating that there might be a theory of this nature, but no authority from any court indicating same. The Stones mentioned that in their brief. What we did at that point was in good faith try to negotiate with Mr. Lonzo and his clients to reach a settlement as to what the damages and the liability would have been.
I guess the point of the question, though, Mr. Simpson, is that both parties are represented by able counsel here. And in the course of that representation, I would anticipate would try to foresee the potential hazards that could exist both at trial and on appeal. And when there's a stipulation that says that if coverage is found, this is the amount we're willing to pay, and should coverage be found, it seems that there would be a problem in then saying, well, but we meant when we entered into the stip that we're going to do it based on contextual ambiguity. We didn't mean we were going to do it based on the Rebernick case or based on how the Court of Appeals would interpret the Rebernick case. And so, therefore, since we hadn't anticipated that in entering the stipulation, we should be able to get out of the stipulation.
I'm not asking to get out of the stipulation. I don't think the stipulation says what you're claiming that it says. Let me go back to the trial court level, if I could just address that issue.
Sure.
What Judge Foley said at the trial court level was, this is contextually ambiguous. I'm not changing what Judge Flanagan did. He said, I'm not ruling on any Rebernick issues. So our alternative then is, all right, let's go ahead and have a trial. What am I going to try in that case? How much is the injury worth? What's the liability picture? I'm not going to try any Rebernick theory because it doesn't even exist at that point. We go to the Court of Appeals and all of a sudden Rebernick is thought of. What the court would be doing here is frankly punishing me for not having a 5-day trial over liability and damages that would not have furthered the Rebernick issue one inch one way or the other, because under Judge Foley's ruling, we've got a contextual ambiguity situation and we're going to have a trial about how bad are his injuries, what's the liability picture?
I guess the reason I asked the question is because it would seem to me that since Rebernick was kicking around at that time and the parties were aware of it, it would seem that if the parties wanted to cover any potential Rebernick issue should it arise on appeal, that could have been part of the stipulation.
Well, I thought when I said acuity does not waive any rights of appeal with respect to the motion for summary judgment and motion to reconsider, that the fact that there was this issue kicking around about Rebernick was covered by that. That's one of the reasons that's in there, is because what we wanted to do is there's no reason to put my client through $10,000 worth of experts and paying me for 5 days for a trial about liability and damages when this was a coverage issue. It's foolish to have Mr. Lonzo's clients have to go through the rigors of a trial and $10,000 for experts and 5 days of trial, and it's foolish to have a jury tied up to do that, all to preserve a record about this Rebernick issue, which we wouldn't have litigated in the first place.
Well, I have the timeline here. July 6th of 2004 was the order denying your motion for summary judgment. Then on December 14th of 2004, the Rebernick decision came down from the Court of Appeals, and it required the kind of notice. It held that the requirement of 632.32.4M that insurers provide notice applies to the umbrella coverage. That's the same thing that we did when we took the Rebernick case. So that was in December. The Court of Appeals came down. Then later December, Acuity files motion for reconsideration. February 7th, 2005, is the hearing on the motion for reconsideration. The parties argue the applicability of the Court of Appeals decision in Rebernick. March 8th, 2005, this court granted petition for review in Rebernick. March 11th, is the circuit court order denying Acuity's motion for reconsideration, and then June 8th, parties enter into a stipulation. So that was after you had already argued Rebernick in the circuit court. We had already taken the Court of Appeals Rebernick decision for review. Um, seems to me that the argument that the stipulation is only about contextual ambiguity, and that was the framework of the parties' minds when we entered into that stipulation, is not a persuasive argument in view of that timeline. Can you respond to that?
Yeah. The trial court judge had said at the motion to reconsider that we're not going to get into the Rebernick thing. I'm holding my ruling is based on contextual ambiguity. And at that point, rather than litigate, we wouldn't have been allowed to litigate the Rebernick issue anyway had the matter gone forward. What we tried to do is to expedite this matter in good faith. And that meant let's avoid a jury trial for both sides if we can agree on what the damages and the liability are. I wrote in here that the agreement does not waive any rights of appeal with respect to the decisions on Acuity's motion for summary judgment and motion to reconsider. The only motions that were pending before the court, we reserved our rights to appeal everything on expressly.
Were the only motions before the court, and I don't have that in front of me, I know that the order, that the summary judgment motion, the court denied it because it found contextual ambiguity.
Correct.
And then you asked for, after a time passed, you asked for reconsideration of the order denying your summary judgment motion and the holding on contextual ambiguity. So that was argued again.
Correct.
Is that the only motion and order before
the court?
The
only motion that was before the court was to reconsider the ruling, which was based on contextual ambiguity. Now, so you understand, my recall is, and I would rely on the record, but Mr. Alonzo could probably confirm this, that the Rebernick case was mentioned. It had been decided in the Court of Appeals, I think you said December, and the argument was February?
That's correct.
Yeah, I think he mentioned it at that point. It obviously,
it was mentioned.
The lawyers don't, sometimes they don't get the decision the day after it's decided and immediately goes into the system. There's a little bit of a drag, a little bit of a lag time there. It was mentioned at the oral argument in passing. It was mentioned in the briefing that Mr. Alonzo raises one of his claims that there ought to be coverage. It certainly was a passing reference, and the trial court's ruling was, as often trial courts do, I'm a new judge, I rotated in, but I'm not an appellate court here, so I'm not going to reconsider. And that's where we were at, and on that record, we made this agreement to avoid a trial and to litigate what the real issues were as far as coverage. After the appeal here, as you know, the Supreme Court decided Rebernick, at which point there still was not a published decision indicating that this million-dollar remedy existed or that there was a violation under our set of circumstances. That was a two-policy case in Rebernick. I won't subject everyone to that
again. I have a little different question for you. We decided Rebernick on a statutory interpretation basis. Subsequent to that, the insurance commissioner has, by rule, said that you don't have to give notice of UIM under umbrella policies. Can the insurance commissioner really change our interpretation of a statute by rule, or is that just surplusage sitting out there?
That's an interesting question, and one I did plan on addressing. And my view of that is that the statutory scheme here provides that the insurance commissioner is charged with enforcement of the insurance code. That's part of the commissioner's job. The commissioner has issued an interpretation. So you understand from a historic, not to digress too far, but so you understand from a historic point of view, this Stone case, I believe, was decided in August of 06. And it was then in September of 06 that an emergency regulation was issued saying that we don't agree with that application, that the statute doesn't apply, umbrella policies don't apply with respect to this notice statute. That emergency regulation then became a permanent regulation as of July 1 of 2007. My view on the legal question that you've asked is as follows. The insurance commissioner is charged with interpreting the remedies and the rights under the insurance code by statute. That is a decision which is not a constitutional law question, for example. If there was a question of the constitutionality of these statutes, I have no question that this court would be the final word on that issue. However, what this is a question about interpretation or application of this statute, which the insurance commissioner is charged with interpreting. Therefore, the insurance commissioner's opinion should control with respect to how the statute applies, not that of the court. There's a difference between constitutional law and basically what's sort of an administrative law type question.
There's more involved than constitutional law and administrative law. I mean, we are a separate and independent branch of government. The Commissioner of Insurance is the head of an agency. It's not like it's the legislature could certainly do that and say, Supreme Court, you were wrong, and amend the statute. I have no problem with that. But I have some significant problems, unless you have a case to tell me, with saying that the insurance commissioner can overrule our statutory interpretation.
Well, the case law says that there is deference. I don't have a case that says specifically overruled.
I understand all the deference, but that's when we're interpreting it the first time around. I have not found a case. Now, I need to do more research, perhaps, that says that the insurance commissioner can overrule this court when we do statutory interpretation. Clearly, the legislature can. They can say, you guys got it wrong, and this is how it should be. But
well, my position on that would come back to the Kranzich, K-R-A-N-Z-U-C-H, I believe, case. Excuse my horrible spelling.
Okay.
But it's referred to in the brief. And in there, the court referred to this insurance, to the insurance code, and indicated that it is for the public welfare and the insurance commissioner shall regulate rights and remedies thereunder. That's what was indicated in the Kranzich case. And that opinion seems to put the authority to determine whether there's a violation and a remedy with the insurance commissioner under Kranzich. And that's the authority I would look to on that point. My other comment with respect to that is the statutory scheme. There is a statute, I believe it's 6, forgive me the number, 601.64 and 601.41 sub 1. Those statutes indicate that the legislature has granted authority to the insurance commissioner's office to administer and enforce the insurance code.
All of that, I agree with you, but I don't think it's on point with what's bothering me.
Well, I guess my position is what would come. That's an interesting issue, but it may be for another day. That is, suppose this court rules that, yeah, this is a violation and this is the remedy, and the insurance commissioner says, no, it isn't. Then if, when we have a violation after July 1 of 2007 or perhaps September of 2006 with the emergency regulation, the question will be what trumps what? Whose interpretation controls? I understand what you're saying about the right of the courts, but the
isn't that Marbury versus Madison?
If it's a constitutional question, I have no question about that. But when the legislature and this court have said that the insurance commissioner regulates this area of the law, and the court's regulation goes to conforming the policies to the law, as we did in the Brunson case. That's a horse of a different color.
You know, though, we have cases where, and I can't tell you for the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, but we've had other cases where an agency that was charged with administering a particular statute by the legislature made an interpretation that we said was contrary to the plain meaning of the statute. And so we said they were simply wrong, and we went the other direction. Now, if you're right, then the insurance commissioner could have told those people, or whatever commissioner it was from a different agency, you don't have to follow the Supreme Court, because I don't think that's a correct interpretation of the law. Now, I don't think we would ever get there.
Well, that's not exactly the same thing, and I want to try to draw the distinction
okay,
there.
Okay, thank you.
That is that in the situation where you are looking at, you were saying, well, what we have found is that the administrative agency exceeded its authority or misapplied the statute. And that's a standard of review of an administrative decision. And that's a little different from saying, well, we think the statute ought to say X, and the administrative agency authorized with handling it says Y. So there is a difference there. The question is whether the standard of review is different. I guess that's what I'm trying to get
this
to.
That's a very interesting question that Justice Rogenczak has posed. Is it in this case?
I think until you get to the point where the rubber hits the road, if you will, when you have a violation where the insurance commissioner says
the rubber hit the road here.
I don't think so.
Why not?
We're not bound by either the emergency rule or the new rule. This is all preceding both. Isn't that right?
Correct.
So neither one is retroactive to us at the moment.
Correct.
You're not arguing it's retroactive.
I'm not arguing that is controlling. I am arguing that that is relevant to consider, just as the Hagler case is and the other cases.
Persuasive, you think.
Correct.
All right.
And I think that's a fair summary of what I'm saying.
It may be persuasive even if it doesn't cover, or it may be not persuasive, right?
I don't know how it's not, but you're right. It's not determinative.
It is not determinative. Okay. So, your red light is on.
Chief, can I ask a question about
remedy? You may.
Thank you. Okay. So, we want the limits of liability. This is a Goldilocks question. Should they be the low limits? Should they be the high limits? Should we keep you to the stipulation? Should there be something else? None of the above? What's your best shot as you sit down for what remedy there should be, and assume that I do not find persuasive the remedy that the insurance commissioner should decide what the remedy is?
Okay, well, we'll throw the insurance commissioner's position out. There is nothing in our state that says that you should match the UIM limit to the bodily injury limit, that you should offer it, that that's what it is, or that's how it should be. There is nothing nationwide that would support the proposition that the court can pull that out of thin air and impose a $1 million limit. The options are to say that there has to be a 5,100 limit, or that there is no remedy provided with respect to this in the statute, and therefore there is no remedy. The problem, the 5,100, to me, actually shows that there really wasn't meant that umbrella policies apply here anyway to begin with, because
but
that's what the remedy is.
We've decided that in Rebernick. That battle's over with. What about your stipulation?
The stipulation, I have gone through, the stipulation was
a stipulation. Should it be remanded at all? Should this case be remanded? And if so, for what?
Remand would be to determine if you believe that there's a violation, and if you believe that there's a remedy, and the remedy would be whatever coverage the Rebernicks can prove they would have bought, then there's an issue of fact as to whether they would have bought the coverage, and if so, how much. And that would be the remand issue if you go that far. There is nothing in the statutory scheme that says this is that type of a limit, this type of a scheme in our state as opposed to other states. There's a 5,100 there. If you add 50 to the 300, that's 350, and they still already receive 510.
That's my question. If they get anything less than 500,000, the company doesn't have to pay anything. Isn't that right?
That's right. And that's there's no statutory scheme. There's no reformation plan to pull out of thin air a remedy that says that this should be changed to be 500 or $1 million. Or anything other than the minimum limit.
Company wins unless we give more than 500 or more.
Unless this court goes to that unprecedented position based upon the other law of the other states.
Or employs, I suppose, the stipulation, enforces the stipulation. That's also.
The stipulation thing, if the court does that, frankly, that the message will be sent is never enter into a stipulation. We'll have a 5-day trial the next time. We won't discuss Rebernick at the trial. And we'll be in the same spot we would have been, other than we'll have spent $10,000 of experts for each side and 5 days of trial time, and a jury spent 5 days for nothing other than paranoia about entering into stipulations. I think there's some real serious consequences to that type of ruling.
The reason you don't have to pay is because an uninsured or underinsured motorist carries less than, or gets less than the amount of the coverage.
I think just the opposite. The tort fees are paid, and our insurance company paid $510,000.
Right.
And we'd either have $300,000 or $350,000, depending upon how you do this.
But that definition isn't in the statutes. It's only in the policy. But there's no policy here. I mean, typically, an underinsured motorist is defined in a policy. Unlike some other things where the definitions are contained in 632.32, that's not contained in 632.32.
Well, I think an underinsured motorist might be defined in 632.32.
I might be wrong. You know, I have to be check on it, but it's my belief that it is, and it's only defined in the policy. In fact, we used to have policies that defined you know, underinsured motorists differently than we do now. So I think it's, but I'll check that.
Well, and that raises a whole another enormous issue. That is, what are the terms of this non-existent policy?
Well, that's exactly it. Because if you're going to follow up and answer the chief's question, that this difference, like the $510,000 that's already been paid, and whether or not they're actually an underinsured motorist under the definition of underinsured motorist, if there's no policy, then there's no definition unless it exists in the statute, and we'll have to check on that.
Okay, well, all I can say, I've never heard of any.
Not defined.
I don't think it's defined
it's
in the statute.
It's not defined in the statute.
I think it's only defined in policies, and there's no policy here to define.
632.4M.
Well, I don't have the statute in front of me right now, and I wasn't so lazy I could have gotten it.
Here it is. No, this is just 4 a.m. I'm just teasing. It isn't the full thing.
It's the statute book in front of you, Mr. Simpson.
The my comment on that is, you know, at this point we've gotten now to the point where we're just going to basically rewrite an entire policy, which is contrary to the practices of the industry with respect to this. Many of these umbrella policies incorporate the terms of the underlying policy into them. I don't know if that's in this particular case because I frankly had not contemplated this angle with respect to the matter. And that's the best I can say with respect to that at this point.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Alonzo, representing the Stones. Glad to see you, too.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Thomas Alonzo, and I represent the Stones in this case. It's nice to be back here. I thank you for the opportunity to come back and argue some additional issues that came up. 2 points I'd like to make, if I may, and they're in response to questions that I heard. And before I lose the points, I'll make them now. One, to Justice Bradley's question, and that has to deal with the timeline. In actuality here, the Court of Appeals opinion in Rebernick was ordered published on January 26th. I filed a letter brief to Judge Foley 2 days later, after it was ordered published, raising that issue in a letter brief to the trial court. That is part of the letter that I sent to Judge Foley is in Mr. Simpson's appendix at pages 178, beginning at 178. And it goes through 190. I attached the entire Court of Appeals opinion. Mr. Simpson responded to my letter by sending his own response to my Rebernick argument to Judge Foley, and that can be found. He sent that on January 31, 2005, and that can be found in my supplemental appendix to my initial brief filed in this case at pages 1 through 3. So this wasn't something that was raised in passing before Judge Foley. Both sides made written argument to Judge Foley as well as argued it when we came before him in early February.
Are you saying then, Counselor, that the stipulation that you entered into contemplated the issue in Rebernick?
Yes, I definitely am. But it was on the table. Both sides argued it before Judge Foley.
So you're saying if they lose on the Rebernick issue, that's the end of the story under the stipulation, according to your understanding of it at the time it was entered into?
That is correct. I understood Rebernick to be on the table. It was briefed. It was raised. I went back in the record and counted, you know, I've seen their argument where they say that it wasn't pled. Rebernick wasn't pled.
I know all that. I'm just asking your understanding of the stipulation.
Yes. I fully felt it was on the table when we entered into the stipulation. When we got to the Court of Appeals, Mr. Simpson is the one, Acuity here, filed the opening brief in the Court of Appeals in which two of their three issues argued in the Court of Appeals dealt with Rebernick and dealt with the idea of what remedy would be available. So my point is, everybody knew that this issue was raised in the trial court and would be subject to the appeal. So to argue that they didn't expect the Court of Appeals to decide this case on the rubberneck issue, it just doesn't hold water. As I was starting to mention, I counted six opportunities that this issue was raised and before this case got to the Supreme Court. The trial court letter brief to Judge Foley, the trial court argument to Judge Foley, the jurisdictional memorandum filed by Acuity in the Court of Appeals, the opening Court of Appeals brief by Acuity, that's four, the reply Court of Appeals brief by Acuity, and the supplemental authority letters filed by both parties once this court decided rubberneck. In those supplemental authority letters, obviously rubberneck, this court's decision in rubberneck had come down. In that decision, as the court well knows, Justice Butler raised the fact that there could be other issues in the case. Yet, in Acuity's supplemental authority letters, they didn't raise these other issues, like it wasn't pled, or it wasn't in the stipulation, or it wasn't argued in a trial court. They were well aware of these things, but they didn't raise that in these supplemental letters.
So your position is before us today that if you win before us on the rubberneck issue, that's the end of the story. The remedy is it's $1 million coverage, and they got to pay you $500,000 or not quite that because they've already paid a little more than $500,000.
Well, as the court well knows, the stipulation indicates that if we succeed on the coverage issue, that they will pay us $500,000.
But isn't the coverage issue different than the rubberneck issue? Rubberneck is a notice question of what, but it doesn't necessarily address fully what might be included in coverage. It just says you have to give notice of it if you're selling a UIM policy or one's in place and you begin to offer UIM under the umbrella.
I hope I'm addressing your question. I'm not sure if I understand it completely.
Okay.
Please stop me if I'm not. But
sure, sure.
My understanding of it is that the parties stipulated that if insurance coverage is found on appeal to exist, and insurance coverage could exist by virtue of reformation of a policy. That's what the Court of Appeals decided in this case. They decided that reformation was the appropriate remedy here. That is a policy being formed. So insurance coverage is being formed. If that happens, then we are entitled to $500,000 in damages. That's what I understand to happen here. And as this court well knows, the decision of the Court of Appeals was that the policy ought to be reformed pursuant to 631.15, which has been cited by all sides here.
Could we find coverage and not find it in the amount of $1 million under this umbrella policy?
I don't think you'll have to get to that issue because the parties agreed to $500,000. But
concern is it doesn't sound to me like the other side thinks he agreed to that. So that's what I'm trying to get to.
Well, I think that, and there was a question on Mr. Simpson's argument concerning, is there anything in the record which would indicate whether Acuity would have issued a $1 million policy in this case? What is in the record is what was filed in the trial court by Acuity was an affidavit of their insurance coverage analyst. And in that affidavit, it's written by someone by the name of Rousseau. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name properly. But in that, it indicates, it's part of the appendix at beginning at page 195. Mr. Rousseau analyzes the Stone's coverages with Acuity. In there, he indicates the whole history here in terms of when UIM umbrella coverage was first offered in 1999. No notice was provided to them at that point. We went over this at last argument. In that affidavit, it indicates, as I read it, it's actually the memorandum which is attached to the affidavit, it indicates that the excess uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is an endorsement to the personal umbrella policy. That leads me to believe, or that leads me to argue, I guess, is that it would be equal to the amount of the umbrella policy that they purchased, which in this case, there's no dispute, is $1 million. So, and I think that that's consistent with what was raised earlier about the insurance at the ad code, where the insurance commissioner defines a policy as being one that equals at least $1 million, an umbrella policy. And one more point I wanted to raise before I lose it, and this was in response to your question, Justice Rogensack, and it deals with, and maybe this is a dead issue now and not so important based upon Justice Abrahamson's question, but in terms of that question as to whether the insurance code or the insurance commissioner, this new emergency rule, can trump the holding of this court in Rebernick, I cited to the court specifically the Sider versus O'Connell case, in which the court said if the regulation is inconsistent with the statute, it is a nullity because this court's first duty is to the legislature, not to the agency. In that case specifically, the court indicated that an administrative rule from the insurance commissioner's office was invalid when it conflicted with the statute. I believe this court has interpreted the statute, went through the legislative history, went through the administrative code, and obviously looked to the language of the statute in Rebernick and definitively found that the statute had to apply to umbrella policies.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Sure.
The opposing counsel has argued that from their perspective, there was no, at least, stipulation dealing with the Rebernick issue. I understand you disagree with that, but that is their position. Now, should the court accept that position for purposes of this review, what happens with this case? Does it have to go back for a remand to determine the amount of at least the amount of the policy that would be purchased by your clients? Do we have to remand it for that purpose?
If I understand your question correctly, is if this court finds that the stipulation in order does not cover the Rebernick issue,
exactly,
does this case have to be remanded? One point I'd like to make, and I appreciate your question, is that the parties raised this contextual ambiguity argument in their initial briefs. So I just wanted to be clear, because there was a statement in the reply brief filed recently by Acuity that we abandoned this contextual ambiguity argument. We didn't do any such thing here. That is still an argument that we're making. So before this court, it seems to me, is before this court decides to remand, it will have to address that contextual ambiguity argument and overrule, I guess, the decision of the trial court, or address it at least, before it gets back to the trial court. But if you find that the stip and order does not deal with the Rebernick issue, bearing in mind I do not agree with that.
I understand.
I think that you're probably right. It would have to be remanded.
And remanded?
For a determination as to whether the Stones would have purchased that coverage. That's the only issue I see.
And how much? No?
I don't think so. Because if you remand it, you will have already determined that, I believe, reformation is the appropriate remedy. It's only how much they would have purchased. You will have found that a policy has been, issued or formed by virtue of reformation because they failed to give the notice as they were required to do under the statute. So it's just how
much.
If they would have purchased it.
Yeah, but if they would have purchased it, the question remains at what amount they would have purchased under the umbrella. I mean, as I understand it, you can buy underinsured motorist coverage under the umbrella at differing amounts, correct?
I would suspect so. I would suspect so. I would think, I mean, they argue for, in this case, a minimum limit state, but, I mean, I question, who ever heard of a $50,000 umbrella policy? I think it has to be at least in $1 million, and it seems to me from the appendix, I'm sorry, from the affidavit filed in the trial court by Mr. Rousseau, that this UIM umbrella coverage is an endorsement to your liability umbrella policy. Therefore, it's in the same amount of at least $1 million, which is what the Stones bought here. I answered your question.
$1 million, that's the answer.
Clearly.
On behalf of my clients, I'm asking for the stipulation to be enforced. I'm asking that reformation, I'm saying that reformation is the appropriate remedy and that the stipulation be enforced to provide $500,000.
Now, is that any different than asking for $1 million?
Under these circumstances, probably not, because of reducing issues and things
like
that.
That's what I'm asking.
Probably not.
If you get less than $500,000, do you get anything?
No. You answered that question before. I'm sorry, you asked that question before, and I think Mr. Simpson answered it in the same way. If this court, I guess, finds...
You asked the question regarding how do you define underinsured motorist coverage. You're responding by reducing clause, which is a different thing. Reducing clause is in the statute and is in policies, but I don't think the definition of UIM is in the statute.
Okay.
So
I apologize.
I might be wrong.
No,
that's
the issue. I'm saying, because in the recent UIM cases we've had, the policy defines the UIM driver in such a way that they're not a UIM driver if their policy is... if their policy is more than yours. I think I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
And the statute doesn't define UIM driver. You don't have a policy, so what are you reforming it to? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think so. I mean, we do have a policy here. We have the umbrella policy.
But you don't have the endorsement. You don't have a UIM endorsement in writing.
Through the umbrella policy.
Yes.
That is correct.
Counselor, was the liability policy, the auto policy, and the umbrella purchased at the same time?
Yes, in 1993.
And when one notice was given to them about UIM coverage, was the umbrella in effect at that time?
No, Your Honor. No,
I don't mean the opportunity to purchase UIM coverage. I just mean the umbrella that they bought for $1 million. Did they have it when the notice was given?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And just so I understand, so your concern is that they should have given then a second notice when it became a new product under the umbrella?
In 1999. Three years later.
Thank you.
When they began offering it. In 1996, recall, they weren't offering UIM umbrella coverage. 3 years later, in 1999, they began offering it, and they gave one important point here is they gave new policyholders notice of this UIM umbrella coverage product that they were offering, but existing policyholders, such as the Stones, they didn't say anything. For what reason, I'm not sure, but that's what happened in the case. I just want to briefly address some other arguments that were made here. One is concerning this court lacking the power or the authority to set a remedy in this case, that it's the insurance commissioner's duty or job to do that. We've set forth in our submissions that the court has the statutory authority to reform under 631.15 and has exercised that authority on several occasions, the Welland case, the Brunson case, as well as the Progressive Insurance versus Hall case. The problem also with the idea that the insurance commissioner is the only one with the authority to remedy this violation of the statute for failing to give notice is that what is the remedy going to be? Is it going to be a fine to the insurance company for failure to comply? It doesn't give the Stones what the statute was intended to provide. It doesn't give them the notice. It doesn't give them the choice. It doesn't give them the opportunity to protect themselves with umbrella underinsured motorist coverage.
Counsel, some states require that UIM coverage be offered. Our statute, 632.32.4M, requires notice of availability. I think some states maybe require UIM coverage, period, just like we do UM coverage. In some ways, the failure to give notice seems like a transgression that shouldn't merit such a wallop in response. I didn't send you notice. I didn't affix a, what's a postage stamp cost, 41 cents maybe. I didn't affix that and didn't send you notice. And now, as a matter of law, you get $1 million. Now, I'm not talking about this case because we have the stipulation to address too, and we'll see how that all plays out. But that just seems like, woo, a pretty, a big wallet for a slight omission. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes. I believe this court has determined by virtue of its decision in Rebernick the importance of insurance knowing about this type of coverage and the importance of the notice statute. It's there to help consumers, insurers, know of the availability, the nature and the amount of coverage they may need. I think this court has determined that the legislature found that providing notice to persons of UIM coverage, and particularly with regard to this case, UIM umbrella coverage, is important to give them the opportunity to protect themselves. Appellate courts in Wisconsin have talked about for years the importance and the need for why people buy umbrella coverage. It's to protect themselves against catastrophic losses. In this case, that's what the Stones would have done had they been offered this particular coverage. They would have been given the opportunity to protect themselves against a catastrophic loss, which is what occurred to Dr. Stone in this particular case. I think it's vitally important that the notice be given. And the repercussion for failure to give the notice, I think, should be the opportunity to purchase this coverage retroactively, which is what the Court of Appeals found. And the remedy is as agreed to by the parties in this case.
Counsel, you said one thing that I'm a bit concerned with, because perhaps you didn't mean to, but I think you may have overstated it. Unless it's in the record, and that's why I'm asking you, because if it is, I need to know where it is. But you said what they would have purchased, and as I understand it, they didn't have notice that this UIM coverage was available. We don't know what they would have purchased. We know what the stipulation is, but is there anywhere in the record that would indicate that we know what the Stones would have purchased had they been given the opportunity?
I understand your concern, and if I stated that, it was a misstatement, or maybe I said a little too much, I guess.
All right.
Let me put it this way. We don't have a statement in the record indicating that they would have purchased this. I don't think you need to get to that question because of the stipulation. However, I think, and this was argued by one of the amicus parties in the case, there should be a presumption, or the court can reasonably have or find a rebuttable presumption that they would have purchased an amount equal to their liability limits. In that way, you know, they've already chosen that amount one time already. I mean, they've already chosen $1 million limits for purposes of their liability coverage. I was...
And is that presumption part of the statute?
A couple cases have... You know, we've this has been cited in the amicus brief as well as in our brief, and I can address it here, but one of the things that has been argued in terms, I don't think you need to get to it, but a way you can resolve this particular issue is have a rebuttable presumption in favor of UIM umbrella limits equal to your umbrella liability limits. It's rebuttable by both sides, so it's fair to both. It comports with Section 632.32, which is remedial and meant to increase, not decrease, coverage. That was held in the Rocker case. I also think that it's consistent with Rebernick and advances the purpose of the UIM statute, 632.32-4M. It's closer to allowing the insureds to choose the coverage and make informed decision about the nature and amount of coverage they may buy, they may purchase. It's not sticking them with some minimum limit amount, which has been advocated by Acuity in this case. It gives them what they likely would have chosen because they chose it once before. They chose $1 million before. Some of the cases we've cited from the foreign jurisdictions provide rationale which seems to support that particular point. One of the cases...
I guess this may be the problem with that. Knowing that of the availability of UIM umbrella coverage being available is not the same thing as wanting to purchase the UIM coverage that may be available. And any individual can go out and purchase an umbrella policy, and in purchasing an umbrella policy for the companies that offer UIM umbrella coverage, they then have the decision of, well, do I want the UIM umbrella coverage? And I would be willing to bet, I don't know this, but I'd be willing to bet that there are a number of examples where people don't purchase both. So I think it puts the cart before the horse to suggest that had they known, they would have purchased, and at that amount, unless there's actually some fact-finding that deals with that in the absence of a stipulation. I understand that it's a dispute about whether the stipulation controls, but if it doesn't, it would seem to me that there's still some unresolved issues here.
Well, it seems, I understand what you're saying, and it seems to me as though in that instance, the insurance company can set forth their evidence to rebut the fact that they wouldn't have purchased this $1 million worth of UIM umbrella coverage in this case. Maybe, for example, they would show that, hey, these people, they have minimum limit coverage, $25,000, $50,000. Here they are claiming they should be entitled to $1 million worth of UIM umbrella coverage. Well, that's a loser argument. On the flip side, in this particular case, the Stones always maintained a high level of coverage. They had $300,000 since 1993. They had $300,000 worth of UIM coverage under their primary policy and $1 million worth of umbrella coverage as part of their policy as well.
Let me tell you what's troubling me about the idea of a presumption. When you go back and you look at the language of the statute, 631.15 sub 4, upon written request of the policyholder or an insured whose rights under the policy are continuing and not transitory, an insurer shall reform and reissue its written policy to comply with the requirements of the law existing at the date of issue or last renewal of the policy. Now, that's what I understand reformation to mean. I don't see anything in that statute that suggests that you can presume what a party would do. What it does is it says, okay, they have to rewrite the policy based on the requirements of the law existing on the date of issue, but you still have the issue of whether or not they would have purchased it. And to write in a presumption into that statute when the legislature hasn't chosen to do that suggests to me a bit of a leap.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last.
Suggests to me a bit of a leap.
You know,
not sure how you respond to that, but that's the concern that I have.
I understand. I mean, it seems to me that there has to be some type of remedy for the failure here. I mean, this court has indicated how important this notice is and this coverage is to insureds. And, I mean, something has to happen to remedy the situation. I believe, or it seems to me, as though a presumption in favor of limits equal to their liability limits is a reasonable way to rectify that or remedy that particular issue.
Could you please outline for me the total amount of the options that we have in front of us? $300,000 has been paid, is that correct?
The Stones recovered or settled with the tortfeasor's carrier for policy limits of $500,000 plus the individual Mrs. Lang, who was the tortfeasor in this case, paid an additional $10,000. So the Stones recovered so far a total of $510,000.
Now, if the amount of stipulation were to be agreed to by this court, that would be $510,000 plus $500,000?
Well, one point I would raise here is that, and this was cited in the Court of Appeals brief, is how you interpret, and Mr. Simpson may have a different point to make on this, but how you interpret the fact that there's $300,000 of underlying UIM coverage and $1 million worth of umbrella UIM coverage, that brings it to a total of $1.3 million of available coverage. So if you subtract out the 500, let's round it off to 500, that the Stones already got, that would make them eligible to receive, had we not reached the stipulation, $800,000. Okay? We reached a stipulation that his total damages, Dr. Stone's and his wife's total damages, were $1,010,000 is what we essentially agreed to. That's where the $500,000 came from. I want to say that the case that I would cite to you, and please don't hold me to it because we briefed this in the Court of Appeals so long ago that I can't remember the exact case, but I want to say it's something like Meyer versus Classified Insurance, which deals with adding the 300 to the million to come up to 1.3. If the court would like, I certainly can supplement it with a letter giving you the exact case name to make it easy for you. I see my red light is on.
If I may.
Justice Prosser.
It's not quite clear to me whether 300,000 would be subtracted from any of these figures or whether those figures would be added to 300,000.
I've always interpreted it as the $500,000, $510,000 that the Stones received from the primary carrier, the tortfeasor's carrier, and the tortfeasor herself would be subtracted from, this is the potential, had we not reached the stipulation, would be subtracted from $1.3 million. The most that the Stones could ever get here from the tortfeasor's carrier, and the tortfeasor in this case, and Acuity here under their own carrier would be $1.3 million. All told, since they already received 510, that leaves them with 790 potentially to get. We agreed to 500,000. That's what the agreement was in the stipulation.
And if I may, Chief, to follow up Justice Bradley, Justice Prosser's question, 500,000 in the stipulation. Why doesn't 300 of that 500 come from the underlying policy? That is, the policy limits of the your automobile liability.
Because I think that the reducing clause issue and things like that would come into play.
Okay, so this stipulation gets rid of all of that by just saying a lump sum figure. But get rid of all of that, I mean things like the reducing clause and how it figures in, gets rid of how you define UIM and whether or not you end up with zero when you compare limits to limits. It's from your perspective. I'm not saying this.
Yes,
it's a 500,000 that's in addition to the 510 already received from the tortfeasors Lang's insured.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Alonzo. Mr. Simpson?
As to this remedy issue, we really have been discussing apples and oranges here, and I want to make it clear my position on that. Mr. Alonzo kept talking about a generalized reformation issue, and then he kept talking about a reformation to conform to statute. I think those are important distinctions here. There is the Court of Appeals, even in the Rebernick decision, spoke about how this was not an equitable reformation situation. The Stone Court of Appeals talked about conforming the policy to statute under 631.15. And my question is, what's the statute you're conforming it to? And there is no such statute in the book that says the coverage shall be the same as the bodily injury limits as we have in other states, for example. The Stone state in their brief, though the statutory language does not specifically state UIM coverage should equal bodily injury limits for umbrella policies, this court's interpretation of the UM statute in Rebernick is more closely analogous to certain full recovery rationale. They indicate that at page 23 of their brief. Page 24 of their brief, they say, while full recovery decisions provide limited assistance to the issues at hand due to the respective state statutes being construed, the reasoning of some courts for the ultimate decision bears consideration. Page 24. Page 21, states with full recovery statutes have typically held UIM statute applies to umbrella policies. There is no dispute we do not have a full recovery statute here. There is no dispute that there is nothing in the statutes that says you can rewrite this policy to $1 million. There is no dispute that this is simply a remedy being pulled out of thin air. 631.15 says you conform the policy to the statutes. It doesn't say the court has the power to pull out whatever remedy it chooses with respect to the matter. That is the heart and soul of this remedy issue. You look at the cases from the other states, and they talk about full recovery, minimum limits. You see what they've done. I don't want to go through that again. But that is the heart and soul of this issue.
Isn't it a basic concept in the law that where there's been a wrong, that there's inherent power in the court to provide for a remedy? I mean, I agree that with you at the moment that the statute doesn't require UIM, doesn't require minimum UIM or maximum UIM. There's nothing in the statute defining UIM. So it's hard to find a remedy. If it was easy to find a remedy, we wouldn't have asked you to come back and brief the issue, right, of a remedy. But there seems to be something wrong when there's a violation of a statute, which we shall accept for the moment. And because of this, or at least it's arguable because of the violation, that these people are out a lot of money or might be out of a lot of money. Doesn't the court have power under its general powers to formulate a remedy? I mean, let alone Article 1, Section, is it 9? For every right, there's a remedy.
Well, to quote from Justice Bradley earlier, this is a walloping remedy for a technical notice violation if you're going to invoke the power of equity here. The court's
Well, I don't agree with it that it's technical.
All right.
No, I mean, I can frame the question differently, too. I just
Well, the lack of a 41-cent stamp, this is a walloping remedy for it, to paraphrase her a little more closely. If you're going to invoke the power of equity with respect to this. Mm-hmm. The courts from other jurisdictions have not invoked the power of equity mm-hmm. to do this. The only courts that have seen fit across the country, it would be precedent-breaking for this court, in my opinion, from the cases I reviewed, many of which this court cited to me, by the way, would be precedent-breaking to say that we can pull out of thin air in the under the guise of equity in this type situation a $1 million remedy for violation of a notice statute.
But yeah, it'll only amount to $500,000. It's half a
piddling $500,000.
Right. It's a half walloping.
A half a walloping.
Let me push you on that. Earlier, in response to Justice Rogenczak's questions vis-a-vis the power of the administrative agency, you kind of suggested, well, their rule was able to, it was almost like a statute. Clearly a statute could trump one of our decisions, but their rule could too. Well, why isn't the rule like a statute here? You say you have nothing to reform it too. There's no statute with minimum liability limits. But certainly there is a rule 6.77 that has minimum limits for umbrella policy. So why is the code reg not good enough? Why do you need to have a statute for reformation purposes?
There is nothing in the statutes that authorizes this reformation. That code section says an umbrella policy is $1 million, I think you indicated. You mean you can find a definition of anything and you can say, well, let's create a remedy and say that's what it is. If this state had a rule that said that you shall issue underinsured motorist coverage to match bodily injury limits, which is what the states have where they've tried this argument as a foundation, be it an equitable theory. I think the one Illinois case that talked about equity said, well, it's reasonable to think they would have bought that because the statute says that.
In response to the chief question, there are cases that talk about reformation as an equitable remedy, and so then they come up with the equitable remedy.
There are in many contexts in this world, there are things such as equitable remedy that are referred to. In the context of the cases that were briefed here, I did not see anything that said that without the statute saying that there's $1 million, you can have your UIM limit should be the same as bodily injury, or your UIM limit should be the same as your uninsured motorist or UM limit. Without a statute that says that, nobody has taken the pathway of saying, well, we can simply out of thin air come up with an equitable remedy. And not even the Court of Appeals did that here, because they based this on 631.15. And the question, of course, which everyone seems to be agreeing on, is there's nothing in the rules of law that justify that remedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson, and thank you, Mr. Lonzo, for hearing yet again in what has is a very troublesome and important case to the clients and to the state. That concludes our hearing in 05 AP 1629 Stone versus Acuity. The court is in recess until its next sitting, which I think is going to be in Hudson, for oral argument. And the court will meet in closed conference at 3:25. We are in recess.